However, the antiquarians have missed this coin. I can find no other mention of it. Another coin. Also a little study in the genesis of a prophet. In the American Antiquarian, I6-313, is copied a story by a correspondent to the Detroit News, of a copper coin about the size of a 2-cent piece, said to have been found in a Michigan mound. The editor says merely that he does not endorse the find. Upon this slender basis, he buds out, in the next number of the Antiquarian. The coin turns out, as we predicted, to be a fraud. You can imagine the scorn of Elijah, or any of the old more nearly real prophets. Or all things are tried by the only kind of jurisprudence we have in quasi-existence. Presumed to be innocent until convicted, but they're guilty. The editor's reasoning is as phantom-like as my own, or St. Paul's, or Darwin's. The coin is condemned because it came from the same region from which, a few years before, had come pottery that had been called fraudulent. The pottery had been condemned because it was condemnable. Scientific American, June 17, 1882. That a farmer, in Casco, Illinois, had picked up, on his farm, a bronze coin, which was sent to Professor F. F. Hilder, of St. Louis, who identified it as a coin of Antiochus IV. Inscription said to be in ancient Greek characters, translated as King Antiochus Epiphanes, Illustrious, the Victorious. Sounds quite definite and convincing, but we have some more translations coming. In the American Pioneer, 2-169, are shown two faces of a copper coin, with characters very much like those upon the Grave Creek stone, which, with translations, we'll take up soon. This coin is said to have been found in Connecticut, in 1843. Records of the Past, I2-182. That, early in 1913, a coin, said to be a Roman coin, was reported as discovered in an Illinois mound. It was sent to Dr. Emerson, of the Art Institute, of Chicago. His opinion was that the coin is of the rare mintage of Domitius Domitianus, emperor in Egypt. As to its discovery in an Illinois mound, Dr. Emerson disclaims responsibility. But what strikes me here is that a joker should not have been satisfied with an ordinary Roman coin. Where did he get a rare coin, and why was it not missed from some collection? I have looked over numismatic journals enough to accept that the whereabouts of every rare coin in anyone's possession is known to coin collectors. Seems to me nothing left but to call this another identification. PROC. Amer. Phil. SOC, I2-224. That, in July, 1871, a letter was received from Mr. Jacob W. Moffat, of Chillicothe, Ill., enclosing a photograph of a coin, which he said had been brought up, by him, while boring, from a depth of 120 feet. Of course, by conventional scientific standards, such depth has some extraordinary meaning. Paleontologists, geologists, and archaeologists consider themselves reasonable in arguing ancient origin of the far buried. We only accept, depth is a pseudo-standard with us. One earthquake could bury a coin of recent mintage 120 feet below the surface. According to a writer in the proceedings, the coin is uniform in thickness, and had never been hammered out by savages. There are other tokens of the machine shop. But, according to Professor Leslie, it is an astrologic amulet. There are upon it the signs of Pisces and Leo. Or, with due disregard, you can find signs of your great-grandmother, or of the Crusades, or of the Mayans, upon anything that ever came from Chillicothe or from a 5- and 10-cent store. Anything that looks like a cat and a goldfish looks like Leo and Pisces, but, by due suppress ions and distortions, there's nothing that can't be made to look like a cat and a goldfish. I fear me we're turning a little irritable here. To be damned by slumbering giants and interesting little harlots and clowns who rank high in their profession is at least supportable to our vanity, but, we find that the anthropologists are of the slums of the divine, or of an archaic kindergarten of intellectuality, and it is very unflattering to find a mess of moldly infants sitting in judgment upon us. Professor Leslie then finds, as arbitrarily as one might find that some joker put the Brooklyn Bridge where it is, that the piece was placed there as a practical joke, though not by its present owner, and is a modern fabrication, perhaps of the 16th century, possibly Hispano-American or French-American origin. Its sheer, brutal attempt to assimilate a thing that may or may not have fallen from the sky, with phenomena admitted by the anthropologic system, or with the early French or Spanish explorers of Illinois. Though it is ridiculous in a positive sense to give reasons, it is more acceptable to attempt reasons more nearly real than opposing reasons. Of course, in his favor, we note that Professor Leslie qualifies his notions. But his disregards are that there is nothing either French or Spanish about this coin. A legend upon it is said to be somewhere between Arabic and Phoenician, without being either. Professor Winchell, Sparks from a Geologist's Hammer, p. 170, says of the crude designs upon this coin, which was in his possession, scrawls of an animal and of a warrior, or of a cat and a goldfish, whichever be convenient, that they had been neither stamped nor engraved, but looked as if etched with an acid. That is a method unknown in numismatics of this earth. As to the crudity of design upon this coin, and something else that, though the warrior may be, by due disregards, either a cat or a goldfish, we have to note that his headdress is typical of the American Indian, could be explained, of course, but for fear that we might be instantly translated to the positive absolute, which may not be absolutely desirable, we prefer to have some flaws or negativeness in our own expressions. Data of more than the thrice accursed tablets of stone, with the Ten Commandments engraved upon them, in Hebrew, said to have been found in mounds in the United States. Masonic emblems said to have been found in mounds in the United States. We're upon the borderline of our acceptances, and we're amorphous in the uncertainties and mergings of our outline. Conventionally, or, with no real reason for so doing, we exclude these things, and then, as grossly and arbitrarily and irrationally though our attempt is always to approximate away from these negative states as ever a Kepler, Newton, or Darwin made his selections, without which he could not have seemed to be, at all, because every one of them is now seen to be an illusion, we accept that other lettered things have been found in mounds in the United States. Of course we do what we can to make the selection seem not gross and arbitrary and irrational. Then, if we accept that inscribed things of ancient origin have been found in the United States, that cannot be attributed to any race indigenous to the Western Hemisphere, that are not in any language ever heard of in the Eastern Hemisphere, there's nothing to it but to turn non-Euclidean and try to conceive of a third hemisphere, or to accept that there has been intercourse between the Western Hemisphere and some other world. But there is a peculiarity to these inscribed objects. They remind me of the records left, by Sir John Franklin, in the Arctic, but, also, of attempts made by relief expeditions to communicate with the Franklin expedition. The lost explorers cached their records or concealed them conspicuously in mounds. The relief expeditions sent up balloons, from which messages were dropped broadcast. Our data are of things that have been cached, and of things that seem to have been dropped. Or a lost expedition from somewhere. Explorers from somewhere, and their inability to return then, a long, sentimental, persistent attempt, in the spirit of our own Arctic relief expeditions at least to establish communication. What if it may have succeeded? We think of India, the millions of natives who are ruled by a small band of esoterics only because they receive support and direction from somewhere else or from England. In 1838, Mr. A.B. Tomlinson, owner of the Great Mound at Grave Creek, West Virginia, excavated the mound. He said that, in the presence of witnesses, he had found a small, flat, oval stone or disc upon which were engraved alphabetic characters. Col. Whittlesey, an expert in these matters, says that the stone is now universally regarded by archaeologists as a fraud, that, in his opinion, Mr. Tomlinson had been imposed upon. Avebury, Prehistoric Times, p. 271. I mention it because it has been the subject of much discussion, but it is now generally admitted to be a fraud. It is inscribed with Hebrew characters, but the forger has copied the modern instead of the ancient form of the letters. As I have said, we're as irritable here, under the oppressions of the anthropologists as ever were slaves in the South toward superiorities from poor white trash. When we finally reverse our relative positions, we shall give lowest place to the anthropologists. A Dr. Gray does at least look at a fish before he conceives of a miraculous origin for it. We shall have to submerge Lord Avebury far below him if we accept that the stone from Grave Creek is generally regarded as a fraud by eminent authorities who did not know it from some other object, or, in general, that so decided an opinion must be the product of either deliberate disregard or ignorance or fatigue. The stone belongs to a class of phenomena that is repulsive to the system. It will not assimilate with the system. Let such an object be heard of by such a systematist as Avebury, and the mere mention of it is as nearly certainly the stimulus to a conventional reaction as is a charged body to an electroscope or a glass of beer to a prohibitionist. It is of the ideals of science to know one object from another before expressing an opinion upon a thing, but that is not the spirit of universal mechanics.